Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. Welcome, ready or not, to the year of Trump. In a few days, the 47th president of the United States will become the 49th president of the United States. While I admit we live in the age of hyperbole, this time it's true. The whole world really is watching. Most people around the world seem scared to death. Others are wildly enthusiastic. But to whichever camp you belong, you can't help but wonder, what's going to happen? The fact is that Donald Trump has dominated American and global politics like no one since Franklin Roosevelt. I know few people who think that's a good thing, but I cannot find anyone who disagrees with that assessment. The corollary is that, like FDR, Trump's power is a function not just of his own personality, but of his unique bond with what's clearly now a majority of the American people. In other words, if you want to understand what's likely to happen during Trump 2, you need to understand the voters as well as the Donald. This episode of New Thinking for a New World aims to shed light on what drives the soon-to-be re-inaugurated president, at least partly by answering a simple question. Why did a majority of American voters choose Trump? Simple question, probably a complicated answer. My guest today is at least as qualified as anyone to explain the Trump phenomenon. Scott Miller is a seasoned political and corporate consultant who knows more about American politics than almost any American politician and is a frequent contributor for New Thinking. Welcome back, Scott.
Well, thanks, Alan. Good to be here.
Let me start by violating a confidence. In August 2023, you and I had an email exchange in which you wrote, quote, "I hate to be so completely predictable, but I'm afraid I still believe, as things stand, Donald Trump will be elected president in 2024, unquote. What did you see 15 months ago that not very many people saw that led you to that conclusion?
You know, actually longer ago, starting in 2011, I have a polling company as well that I work with, Armada, and our research began to show this tide of alienation and anger and frustration among not just a small group or a MAGA group, but upwards of 80% of the American people. By 2016 election, about 84% of Americans of all demographics, all political stripes, would agree with the statement that an elite of incumbent politicians of both parties, lobbyists, big banks, big unions, big business, big special interests, and big media rigged the system in Washington, D.C. to protect their own power and prestige. That was then. It's only grown. So that level of alienation from the political system, what we found in our research is that people believe that the system is broken, that the system is corrupt, that the system attracts the corrupt. So, I mean, it's a pernicious situation, I recognize. We can't have go on forever with people not trusting government. And this election, those trends continued. And the big headline, of course, is that, well, you know, I guess, of course, Trump was a change candidate, even though he'd been president. He was essentially an incumbent, sort of an incumbent or an incumbent hybrid. But the fact is, I don't think he really captured the change vote that was out there to get. About 75% of Americans said that we're on the wrong track. You know, that right track, wrong track measure is one of the key measures of what, you know, if someone's likely to win or lose. Well, wrong track, 75%. 63% in the New York Times Siena poll said that we need radical change from the Biden administration. Now, that level of energy for change, I don't think Trump quite captured. It's partly because he's Trump.
Let me interrupt only to pull on that thread. Trump already been president. He completely dominates the Republican Party. He is part of the elite from one perspective, but somehow he still is perceived as anti-elite. He's the only anti-elite billionaire, I suspect, walking the planet at the moment. How do you get away with that? How does he do it?
What people read as authenticity is his inability to act politically correct. He's a narcissist. He says what he wants. He says what's on his mind. He's very spontaneous, to say the least. And they see that as somebody who's not a politician. Being a politician is worse than being an anchor on MSNBC as far as most voters go. And I think that goes to him. But he recognizes the power of the working class. The Democrats totally lost their grip on the working class, particularly in this election, which is probably the biggest thing that happened to have them lose. I mean, they treated the working class. Now, working class, as you and I know, about more than 55% of our voters in the United States are working class families, men and women. They are under $100,000 income and no college degree. And they are working class, working class, working class all the time. The Democrats treated them through identity politics, African-Americans, Hispanics, Latinx, whatever they were calling it, and white working class. But the fact is, if you're working class, you're working class first before identity, really, because you get up in the morning and
you work. And if you want to eat, you work.
And if you eat, you're paying for it. And you're paying for your kids' meals. You're thinking about your kids going to school. You're thinking about the gas prices. You're thinking about inflation all day long. And that was a particular sting for these people. The first 2 years cost them $8,000 a year. First 2 years of the Biden administration cost them about $8,000 a year of money they don't have. We know that $400 will bankrupt the average working class family. And it's a terrible situation, but I'm both an optimist and fundamentally like these people because they're pragmatic. They don't choose where they're going to live. They have to be pragmatic, not by choice. They don't choose their neighborhood very much. They don't choose their church, their schools. They don't choose who they go out to work with, what work crew, all of that. And they get along. And frankly, they're very moderate socially relative to others. We have elites who you and I are part of what would be called elites who choose where we want to live. These people live where they live and they tend to figure out how to get along. And they're as I say, practical by necessity. They're moderate, again, probably by necessity, and very decent people. But they've been frozen in a bad situation for 35 years. So it's something America's got to reckon with. But the Democrats lost them altogether.
You said to me recently that, and I wrote this down at the time because it struck me as probably true, but certainly surprising, that in some ways Trump is a centrist. And more importantly, is perceived by the people you're describing right now as moderate, as a centrist, no sense of extremism, even though most of my progressive friends think he is somewhere to the right, not of Hitler, but of Attila. Is that the case?
That's the case in research. Nate Silver, who is a very reputable analyst of polling, and Nate Cohn of the New York Times are the two of the pollsters I trust a great deal. But Silva said early on, first of all, he said, as I did, it's Trump's to lose. But he's more popular when he entered this campaign, more popular than he'd ever been. And, you know, when you think about our news cycle and the turbulent change we've had over the last many years, 6 years ago is a long, long time. So a lot of the wounds had healed that he may have caused. But yeah, Nate said he's seen as a centrist. He is seen as better able to protect our democracy than Kamala Harris. So that's what the American people said. The Democrats chose to ignore this. I know for personal experience that the inner Biden campaign, the bubble, that small group of people at the very core of the campaign, mostly his family, did not look at numbers that were not good. They were just weren't even shown. I mean, this is probably not unusual. You know, Emperor, those clothes looked great. But they, I don't know if they saw this slipping away, but they were missing. And the Democratic Party has shifted radically. When I joined the party back in Boston in the early 1970s, it was the party of the hairy armed sons of toil, they would call it. I mean, it was a working class blue collar party. And with minorities as well. They've lost that. This is the party of urban, advanced degree, wealthy, somewhat young people who are progressive. And frankly, it's the only group with which they've gained ground in the last election were these, you know, high degree, wealthy, elite, mostly white, urban and suburban people. That's a radical change that began in 2012. And you could see it, you can chart it. The Economist, which is hardly a conservative publication, looked at it and showed this abrupt left turn that the party took in 2012 and since then toward identity politics and progressivism. And that left behind the working class. And that's the American electorate.
This is the party of Obama, of Biden. I wouldn't say of Harris because she's not a driver of anything. She was, whatever she was, it was an accident in some way. Was that a conscious choice, do you think, on the part of the Democratic Party leadership to shift towards a more progressive, towards richer, towards less working class, or do they just stumble into it? Is there strategy or is this accident?
To attribute anything that either party does to strategy is a little bit optimistic. No, it was stumbling and bumbling, and it was complacent. It assumed that they would hold blacks for sure. You know, they've got them. That's part of our base. It was assumed that they would hold Hispanics. It was assumed they would hold women. I mean, one of the things that puzzles me, because I'm really totally unqualified on the issue of abortion. I'm partly just being a man, but I don't know enough about it. But they certainly thought it would be a powerful issue, and it was not. It was a powerful issue on a local level and on a state level. And it certainly activated people, but it didn't activate them to vote in the national election for Kamala Harris. Indeed, Joe Biden in 2020 did better with women than Kamala Harris did in 24. And I don't see, you can attribute it to sexism or racism or whatever, but it's something deeper than that. It just, the issue did not take. And I think, you know, frankly, those people who cared about the issue found better ways to be active on it. And had the opportunity on many state ballots to do so. It's breathtaking to see what's happened to the party. And part of it was by design. I mean, yes, I wouldn't say strategy, of course, but I think part was by design of wanting to dominate social media. And social media at that, you know, over the early teens, had more power with those groups of elites than it did with others. And now it's everybody. I mean, the amazing thing in this election, you and I have talked about this at length. If you ask people, and this is the New York Times Siena polling, where do they get their news? Well, 10% get their news from Fox. And that's pretty amazing because 6% get their news from the combination of ABC, NBC, and CBS. And 6% get their news from the combination of the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal. But most breathtaking in the last Siena poll before the election, 19% say they get their news from TikTok. And, you know, that makes people go, you know, they palm to the forehead and go, Jesus, what's happening to our country? Well, it's not so different from what things were when I was young. And it was the person on the bar stool next to you or across the back fence, you know, that was shaping in your union hall and everything else, you know. So it's still, I kind of trust people to get, I've never seen in my adult life, and I'm an old guy now, I've never seen the American people make a mistake, given the information and given the choices they had. And these were not the American people would not have pulled these choices out. If you remember, Trump in the early primaries was a contender, but not the. People might have thought that Ron DeSantis or, you know, that Nikki Haley could have taken the nomination. The thing that put Trump in the spotlight and put him out front was Alvin Bragg and Fannie Willis indicting him, lawfare. It absolutely backfired. I mean, it was really, as a strategy, it was the gang that couldn't shoot straight. I mean, that put Trump and, you know, hit, and then his own, you know, P.T. Barnum-ness took over, and he used the... He still today on his Truth Social uses the mugshot from Fannie Willis as his essential campaign poster. But he was not there. And then for Kamala Harris to be Kamala Harris didn't even contend in the Democratic primary in California in 2020. I mean, she was out before the first primaries. And the fact that she was chosen to be the candidate, the question would be by whom and how and when. Historians are going to have an incredible amount to deal with in this campaign.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
I have to say, I hope I live long enough to read that history, because here's a country, as you said earlier, that doesn't trust institutions anymore, doesn't trust politicians, doesn't trust presidents, doesn't trust Supreme Courts. And the Democrats managed to become the party they don't trust by a very traditional, let's pop this candidate out of nowhere. No process, no primary, nothing other than a tweet on a Sunday afternoon, almost guaranteeing that candidate was fighting from behind from day one, even though the initial campaign, as you pointed out in a podcast we did last fall, The August campaign was a good campaign.
Yes, it was.
They somehow managed to take her approval rating from 30 to 40 inside a couple weeks. And then something broke, that lack of trust, that who she really was. But let me turn that as a question. Kamala Harris ultimately failed. She lost. And that's this is a binary system. You win or you lose. She lost. Why did she lose? Did she lose or did he win? Or both?
It was actually both. That's a good qualifier. It was really a combination of both. Sometime two things happened that were kind of astounding. First was that, of course, that day, that Saturday in July, when somebody got to President Biden and convinced him to get out of the race. Now, that morning, he was in the race. The next morning, he's out of the race. You know, 20-some members of the Biden family have no source of income besides lobbying. And it's hard to believe that he could just be giving it up. Furthermore, he thought he could win. And he's been saying so to this very day. He's been saying, I could have won. And he believed it. He beat, you know, Trump in 20, thought he could beat him again. But he couldn't. I mean, the numbers were very clear nationally that he could not win. And he would have gotten, you know, lost that 75-25 wrong track, right track, and the 63% who wanted a radical change. That would have eliminated him. But the fact that she got in there, you know, even the Democratic primary voters are fairly a little bit older and fairly conservative generally. That sometimes there'll be an infusion of youth, as there was for Barack Obama, but not often. And the people who voted Joe in after South Carolina primary and Jim Clyburn endorsing him at that point, they were thinking he was going to be a moderate Democrat. So to have picked suddenly a progressive Democrat to be the candidate, even left of Biden, seems incredibly a huge mistake. I don't know how they did it or why. And of course, Mrs. Harris had the problem also that her campaign was being run by the Biden campaign. Essentially, all of her staff was Biden communication staff, plus David Plouffe and Jim Messina from the Obama campaigns. And I think she got singularly bad advice not to do well. Whether she didn't want to do press or they didn't want her to do press, she didn't do it. And when she did it, to the most, you know, softball, beach ball kind of press, being the View on ABC, she was asked that critical question. And that became a critical moment in the campaign when they said, can you think of anything that you would do that you would change from the Biden administration? She said, no, I can't think of a thing. And of course, that became one of the central themes of the on-air advertising for Trump, as well as the transgender operations for illegal aliens. That astounding ad that was very powerful. But something also happened with Trump, and this is something I do think that history will notice. By the time of the Butler assassination attempt, and even after enduring the Republican National Convention, when he could have seized on that and to show some change, he was still running the 2020 campaign. This campaign was stolen from me. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to get it back. And that just doesn't register with most Americans. Sometime in August, he literally changed his tune. And I think he changed his mind. And he began running in 2024 again. And he began running with the 2016 messages. You know, he would say, I'm not the message you are. I'm just the messenger. We're gonna stick it to the elites in Washington. And he was running as an insurgent again from August on. And that's when, as you pointed out, that's when she had a good month going into August, but then just kind of ran out of gas. They didn't come up with new ideas. They didn't really challenge Trump effectively. They were challenging him on this issue that he would be a fascist. I challenge you to find out how many Americans know what a fascist is. And they kept using that language and Hitler. As I said in the research, Trump was seen as better able to protect our democracy than Kamala Harris. And, you know, don't confuse me with the facts. That's what the American people believed.
me ask you, though, because that is probably the thing that most of our audience most cares about. Is Trump a danger for democracy, which is what the Democrats were telling us?
Well, he's been president, and we have two, you've got 4 years more or less of not being a dictator, not trying to do that. And then you've got January 6th, in which his behavior was disgraceful, if not traitorous. But I think the American people felt, they don't see that. Really only, again, the Democrat elites see that as a huge issue. These are the people who installed Kamala Harris as the candidate with not one vote, that they see, but they truly do see Trump as a real threat to democracy. I would tell Democrats, and I have a lot of friends, obviously, that are Democrats, that they were elevating Trump early on by their fear of him. I said, he's not seen as that dramatic a character to the American people. But I think, as you said earlier, it was a combination of her losing it. I'm surprised she did as well as she did, frankly. 89% of counties in America shifted to the right in this election. The state and local elections were pretty profound. Gubernatorial elections, pretty much so. The congressional elections were not nearly as much of a landslide. They never are. The American people don't like Congress. I mean, they like their congressperson usually, but they don't like Congress. They don't like the Senate. You know, they just think they're a bunch of stuffed shirt elites, and the Senate and the House of Representatives constantly come through to live up to that reputation. So it was that combination of both things. And I would say it's still going on, by the way. I think, and this is probably true in many elections, Trump is winning more votes since November 5th. In 2016, I think he lost votes. It's subjective just people's attitudes and perceptions. But I think in 2016, people said, wait a minute, did we really elect this guy? I can't believe it. And the demonstrations and the anti-Trump and the pussy hat parade and everything began. Now, he's getting more votes since November 5th.
By which you mean that if somehow the election was reheld today, he would do even better than he did back in November.
Yeah, I do believe that now. And again, here's a really subjective point of view of mine. But I don't know how you argue it. I think Trump is probably the luckiest son of a bitch who ever walked into the White House. I mean, he things go his way. To see what's happened since the election. Obviously, sometime after the first Trump-Biden debate, Netanyahu and his government made the decision that they could do what they want to do, what they need to do, what they felt compelled to do without Joe and without, Tony Blinken and without Jake Sullivan. They felt they could ignore them, and yet the arms would still flow, and they were right. That was a hell of a gamble. But that allowed them to, Biden called for a ceasefire in Gaza and then in Lebanon and asked for measured response to Iran. And certainly all of the things that Israel did, putting aside the little detail of the goriness of how they did it, the terrible consequences on civilians, which you have to blame on both sides, but it came out the way they wanted. The Iran has been greatly reduced. And that, as Trump enters his office, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has become a stalemate. And it's now thought of as a war, not an invasion. People have sort of lost the central fact that this began because Putin invaded in February of 21. But, he will be able to broker peace there pretty quickly. What happened with Canada and Justin Trudeau, who was not popular. I mean, I think, with your audience, particularly in Talberg Foundation, so many people who have global view, we're seeing this all around the world of the rise of populism, anti-immigration. It's explainable, but and it may be deplorable to some people. But the fact is, I think it may be looked at as a correction on the part of those people who voted.
The other thing that's happened during these weeks, of course, is that he has stood up a government faster than any recent presidents have done so in terms of nominations or appointments. Many of the usual suspects are highly critical of the nominees, but nonetheless, he's knocking out nominees at a rate that we've literally never seen. I'm tempted to take your observation that you think his popularity is rising, his sense of governing already is working in his favor. People are seeing something showing up that maybe the New York Times and a lot of my progressive friends don't like the nominees, but they're seeing a government get ready to operate fast, and they're surprised by it, and they're pleased by it.
Yeah, and it's clearly in 2016 I went to the Republican convention and. As I've told you, it might as well have been a plumbing fixture convention. I mean, there was nobody there. There was very little energy. The press barely paid attention to it. And when Trump won, surprising even him, he had no sense of how to manage. The thing he had managed so brilliantly for many years was his own brand. And he's a very smart businessman. And he has a feral sense of competition that is uncanny, but he does identify with the average person. He claims it's because he grew up on construction sites. That's not true. He grew up in elite schools, and this time is very different. And it's not all about the plans that have been made, but plans have been made, and also that the entire Republican Party belongs to him. There is not one outlier that I can think of Liz Cheney, but she's not in the party, so he's really consolidated power mostly in the last year. He's extremely energetic this time. And last time he was it looked lazy. He's not a lazy person, but he's very energetic in trying to get this done fast, because I think he recognizes, as anybody does, you come out of halftime in a football game with the lead, you want to get that momentum back immediately. And I think he has that opportunity. And they talk about shock and awe of the early days where executive orders, he will try to push those things. I think he'll do what he said he was going to do and focus on two issues from day one, most, which is energy and drill, baby, drill, and then the immigration and cutting off the southern border, fortifying the southern border. And he's got very strong support from the American people on that. So it won't be easy, any of it. And knocking down inflation is going to be very hard. But he's got a lot of slack to deal with. In terms of the nominees, I think Gates, as an example, Matt Gates, as I mean, just seems like a pretty terrible human being. But I have a feeling that his nomination was a way of saying, that's what I think of our Department of Justice, and that this guy will be an approval, an improvement. And then, you know, to follow up with a good candidate, Pam Bondi, you know, was pretty quick and pretty agile. Whether, you know, Pete Hegseth is, will he be approved? I doubt it. That may be the other one, but I think that Tulsi Gabbard will be. I think that, you know, obviously Rubio, I think will be easily. I think he'll get a lot of his people in very quickly and be running from the start. And they all have that energy, that sense of momentum that they can get a lot done if they get it done fast. And they know if they don't get it done within the first 2 years, it'll never happen.
Let me end, and I hate to do this, with a softball. On the spectrum of hope to fear, I confess that many of my friends are clustered around fear. They're terrified of what the next 2 years, especially if you're right and he gets a lot done, will bring. Where are you on hope to fear?
Well, it's an unfair question because I'm such an optimist, and I have such faith, as I've said, in our voters to make the right choices at the right time. Trump will still be Trump. I mean, there'll be, you know, these very bad moments, but I think what you can see in business and in the Wall Street in general that momentum is translating. That happened in 16, in fact. The Trump boom began without Trump doing anything. It was simply the sense that, oh, we've been, you know, released from the regulatory aims of the previous administration. So I'm very optimistic always, but I'm particularly optimistic this time because the government and the people pretty much agree, and that's unusual.
Scott Miller, thank you for the conversation. Thank you for your friendship over many years, but also I've learned a lot of politics from you, and I think most of it actually makes sense. So thank you very much.
Not sure. A lot of people would certainly not agree with that, but thanks a lot, Alan. I really enjoy it and love Talberg, of course.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at talbergfoundation.org.